I feel very, very grateful that I'm not a perfectionist. Because God, it would kill me. You know, I'd still be working on album one, and by the time it would be done, it would probably be worse than what I'm doing now. You know, I think the quickest way to make a perfect record is to make 100 not perfect records.
First, you make a fake band. Second, you make an amazing chamber pop record. That's what happened on Cacophony by Gumshoes. 9 songs, each detailing a different member of this fictional band from the late 1990s. The band in question, filled with weirdos, anarchists, wannabe alien abductees, but the main thing you need to know is that Gumshoes, the mastermind behind all of this, makes sure that nothing gets too heady in the way of the hooks. The wonderful, wonderful hooks. And we talked to Gumshoes today, right here on The Woodhouse.
So, I mean, this is kind of a random thing, but the first thing that I kind of thought of when I was reading through the band camp, you're talking about 1996, this kind of anarchist band that, you know, plays for absolutely no one. The first thing that came to mind was like Chumbawamba if they didn't get their big one-hit wonder. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, I totally get what you mean. I like that. I mean, Chumbawamba are fascinating on their own. I love Chumbawamba, but it's kind. I love that whole little like gray area in the 90s of punk bands who are like either holding over from the 80s or some of them are breaking through or completely like falling out of the radar. I love that kind of wilderness zone in punk history. It's so cool.
Is that why you kind of picked that time period for this story?
Yeah, a little bit. I was reading through, have you read Our Band Could Be Your Life?
No. Oh, yes. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, that's about as good a music book as you're going to read. And that's that whole period of like when punk is coming up and it's, you've got all these new amazing innovative artists. It's so fascinating. But then I kind of think of so many of the stories in that book end with, and then they came up on a major label and made a couple records there, or then they had these legendary careers and huge impacts. And I was thinking, well, who were the hangers on? You know, who's still going in the 90s doing nothing? What if, you know, what you have the Butthole Surfers being as crazy as they are? What if you had a band equally crazy who no one cares about? You know, they must be there. I don't know. I find it interesting to think about people holding the torch after it's gone out.
Do you watch Todd in the Shadows?
Yeah, of course. He's great.
Yeah, the first thing that you just mentioned, Butthole Surfers, but his whole joke of like Nirvana either killed or started my career, of like all the glam metal bands dying, but then like Butthole Surfers, Meat Puppets, you know, people got interested in the Melvins, you know, of all this stuff.
Insane imagining like the Melvins on a major label, like Butthole Surfers on MTV. It's awesome.
I think I'm understanding now why you put that era, because it was this like the record labels were like, we have to find Nirvana too, so we're just gonna go for whatever Kurt Cobain ever listened to.
I can't imagine like any other period in history where one person's taste has had so much impact, you know. I like to imagine Cacophony as a band Cobain hated. He saw like once and thought it was awful.
Yeah, I mean, we'll go to the band Cacophony next, I guess. Where, outside of the era that you kind of came up for it, where did the concept of talking about this band and then, or making up this band and then also having each song deal with a different character start from?
Well, there are two angles to look at that. There's the angle of why did I write about this, and like in terms of why did the content appeal to me? And there's the angle of like, why did I think this was something I could and should do, you know? Because my style of songwriting is, I don't understand, and I really envy people who can sit and just sort of like feel the artistic spirit move through them, and they write whatever their intuition is saying, and, you know, moved by poetry and whatever's in their soul. That's not me. I realized very quickly that I'm the kind of guy who, every song I've ever written, I come up with the concept and I write to that concept. It's very much picturing the house and then starting to place the bricks, you know? Like so many of my songs I write like title first even. So I knew for album 3, I was really itching to do some kind of slightly silly, slightly overambitious concept, because that really appeals to me as a so I was kind of throwing my head against a wall of, okay, what kind of themes do I want to write about, and how can I capture those themes? And I would think about it a lot, and I knew I wanted to talk about I'd done a second record which was really pessimistic, right? I'd done this record that was really all about doom and dread and everything going wrong, and I kind of wanted the flip side of that. So I was like, I want to focus on resilience and rebellion and the idea of staying true to what you believe in despite everything going wrong, you know. And I think I must have been listening to some band like that when it kind of clicked into my head of it's punk, you know. Punk is all about that. Is I don't consider myself much of a punk. I make pop music, but the spirit of it is so evocative. It's so it's it feels like an idea greater than itself. And I thought there are so many different angles you can look at it in. And I think I found that album cover in like an old book illustration from like the 1800s, and I was like, okay, it's all over. I gotta do
So concept often starts first. From there, are you primarily starting with piano or just whatever kind of comes to hand?
It's well, for this album, I wanted to do usually I write songs in a really traditional way, right? I really like the idea of just the super songy song, the idea that I can sit at a piano and play a bunch of chords and a verse and a chorus and a verse and a chorus, and I can just get a song out of there like that. But this record, I wanted to test myself. I wanted to have more like come up with a lick that I can repeat for a long time and build on top of it. I wanted like, you know, here's a simple chord progression that loops really nicely. I wanted to go a bit more arrangement first. That was the experiment. I'm not sure I'm going to be sticking with that in the future. The songs I'm writing at the moment are much more songy again, but that meant I was, for this album in particular, it was a lot of like, come up with a musical idea I like, see what it sounds like repeated, come up with a melody that fits on top of it, and very much like have the bass layer and then worm the lyrics into it. I feel like I spent all my time writing lyrics, just making them fit on the melody nicely, just banging my head against a wall why the syllable doesn't sound right. But I think I managed to make it work. I hope so.
I think you did.
Oh, thank you.
That actually makes more sense for me because one of the things that I noticed was there's definitely a lot of different rhythmic changes from song to song. I'm thinking a particular real thing in Low Fantasy, and that makes more sense from the riff starting first on both of those songs and sort of controlling what the rhythm and the rest of the song is going to be like from that riff.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is connected, but what is your relationship with nostalgia?
This is interesting, as I'm not a nostalgic person at all. I really don't have the instincts of looking back and reminiscing. I don't like, I always worry I don't take enough pictures of my life, but like, I'm very much a I like nostalgia almost like academically, you know. I like the idea of digging through a scene and learning about it. I like the idea of I like history, but I don't have that warm feeling of things were so much better back then. I wish I could be in that era. But I kind of like it from this detached, oh, I don't want to be there, but I do want to write about it. I do want to learn about it. Yeah, I guess it's not an emotional thing for me. I don't know. It's a good, interesting question.
I wonder partially because obviously all of these different characters, and when you're talking with somebody who's made an album who is going from character to character, it's like, okay, how much of that character was serving a song and how much of that character is you? Nostalgia does come up a lot for a lot of these characters, especially Last Living Kennedy.
I just realized the song, The Real Thing, is supposed to be all about nostalgia. I don't know if I forgot that. That's almost a song against nostalgia, really. That's a song about nostalgia killing you. The I guess considering that character joined a punk band, I guess he got over it, but there's a sense of the nostalgia is painful, you know. I admire these characters because they get over it and find something to do in the present.
Many different things in the present, all these sorts
Yeah.
of different avenues that they go through. I mean, going on from that, I thought it just worked. It had to be the theremin player that was searching for aliens, right?
Of course. I imagine all thereminists are searching for aliens.
That was kind of the secondary thing, and during the writing process of like, not all of the instruments that you're describing necessarily show up in the same ways or show up at all from, the character saxophone talking about magic and all of these sorts of things. And I was wondering for you, how you kind of decided this is what they are doing post cacophony and how it may relate to your relationship with the instrument.
Well, I won't pretend this is the music that came first. Like Low Fantasy, I'd written a song about this sort of, desperately finding magic, and I was like, oh, that's a song that sounds kind of like it has a fake horn section. Maybe they can be the saxophonists. And one much deeper than that. So some of them were kind of shoehorned in retrospectively. But I mean, there are definitely a few that I think there's a much firmer connection, especially the drummer. Because Last Living Kennedy is the drummer, and I think of all these drummers that bounce from band to band, sort of holding it down at the back. Well, you've got, front people and guitarists going all nuts and taking all the attention. And there's something that feels almost like a sense of duty, of the long-term drummer. And then, so Last Living Kennedy was always going to be the drummer. What else? I also think on the title track, what instrument did I say he played? I've forgotten. He's like a tambourinist or something. I was thinking of I think that was a Butthole Surface thing, is reading their chapters, and they would just have like a guy on the stage who would just like jump around vaguely shaking an instrument but not actually contributing to the song, but just like as performance, as attention, and that's really like fascinating to me. It's just sort of, I just wanted sort of whimsy and all these different ways you can express yourself on a stage, I guess, which I've never gotten to do.
I mean, it's an interesting thing hearing from like a one-man band, creating all these different characters in this huge, Chumbawamba polyphonic spree kind of, there's like nine members up on there, all coming from one person is an interesting dichotomy.
Yeah, it is a little bit. But yeah, I needed that many songs.
We just talking about, the discovery of magic in Low Fantasy or attempting to discover magic. That's always been an interesting thing for me because music is often, related when we're talking about music, it's related as a magical quality, whether it's healing or being able to transfer emotions to other people. But that song is feels like so much of running into the reality of music at the end is art and it's awesome, but it's not magic necessarily. It's not going to cast a spell, really.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because I wasn't even thinking of Low Fantasy strictly in terms of creating music. It's just in terms of, I guess, like desperation, the sense of like I'm looking for something more, something beyond, something above like a dull, simple life, whether that's in like, a political utopia or art that changes the world or whatever the abstract punk spirit is. It feels intangible, it feels like magic, but you gotta go for it.
Yeah, it does seem like all of these characters are kind of searching for things that are not necessarily music anymore, but things that are connected to music that are related out, like magic as music or music as magic. Claire de Lune is looking for, the spirit of political revolution through music. Nobody's literally having kinetic energy and, all of these things. It's like things that we connect to music but are not necessarily music is feels like where these characters are now.
Yeah, like music as spirit, you know. I'd imagine a lot of people who became punk in the first place, you know, all those early punk rockers, a lot of them probably the music wasn't the appeal. It was the rebellion. It was the innovation. It was the sense of being something more, being something different. And that's the kind of like desperation and hope that I find so compelling.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of that, man, when I first saw the track list, Clair de Lune 2 really made me laugh. Just
I'm
like,
glad.
It's a good joke, but it is, you know, there's almost a little bit of a megalomania there for that character of like,
definitely.
If there was just this sequel, then the entire world would go up into a riot. And like that is pretty punk of like, you know, you imagine the first people to see the Sex Pistols in a bar probably thought that it's like, yeah, we're going to end the world with this shit.
Yeah, 100%. Early punk especially seemed very optimistic on what they could do with it, and you know, good for them. I just find it funny putting sequels on things that don't make sense as sequels.
Clair de Lune 2 is not something I would ever thought of, but it works for sure.
I'm glad.
I more on kind of the character parts on Puppet Waltz. I'm curious about that song because you're almost like playing a third hand character. You're playing a character who's playing through a different character. And I was just curious about the writing for that, especially because it's talking about fame and anonymity in that song, which is fascinating to put it through this ventriloquist, you know, angle.
Yeah, this was part of me introspecting about my own songwriting, really, in that I write character songs, right? I, you know, years ago when I first tried writing songs, I thought, oh, I'm going to be this real confessional, you know, spilling my heart on the page songwriter. I'm going to make music that people really feel like they know me from. And then as I grew up and wrote more songs, I realized, God, no, I don't want that at all. That sounds awful. So I really love songwriting as a format to sort of purposely distance yourself like that, but distancing yourself in these sort of interesting ways that let people interpret it and identify with it in whatever angle they choose. So I think of all these songwriters I love who seem to only write as characters. Bill Callahan was big on my mind for that one because he spent first half of his career writing songs as just this absolutely like scummy down in the dumps dude. And he was amazing at it, but you never listened to a Bill Callahan song and felt like you knew anything about Bill Callahan. And yet he was still such a compelling songwriter and is. So I guess the Puppet Waltz is trying to get at that. There's like an honor and a freedom in making impersonal art, I guess, in expressing yourself through someone else through a distance.
It's really funny you bring up Bill Callahan. He lives in my neighborhood.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, I'm in Austin. So, yeah, he's...
That's awesome.
He's just around.
I imagine him sitting on a porch, you know, at this point.
Yeah, you know, he's gotten the more personal, domesticated songs now, which are great, too. But, you know, definitely listening to early Smog stuff of just these conveyor belt of drifters and assholes and losers that just populate his albums. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I used to write a lot of songs about bad people. I don't know why. There's a draw to it.
I mean, Nick Cave too. You know, there's this, there's a draw there to the fascination of a downfall or someone who's already experienced their downfall.
It's nice to sort of, if you want to write songs that are like exploring or critiquing human nature, it's fun to do that first person.
Yeah, for sure. So the song that really caught me, because it's the first song that kind of cues up on Bandcamp and I've been listening to a ton, is Nobody's. And first and foremost, as a drummer, I'm extremely mad that you just did, like, it is so exhausting to play. I've been trying. It's just 16th notes the entire goddamn time.
It's I luckily I did not play those live. Those are digital. Which I've there are some things on that record that if you had to play in real life, God, I pity you.
Is that what else would be what else would be in that category of just like, okay, I digitized this because this would just be absolutely incredibly annoying to play.
I almost the entire record, honestly. Like there, I have piano parts for three hands. You know, I have all those drum parts where I'm playing like three different drums on different sides of the key at once. You know, I mean, pretty much the whole record is synthesized to some degree. I try and hide it a little bit, but I'm really bad at recording with microphones, so that's my alternative.
I think that song struck me as that incredible balance, what you were talking about before, of resilience, because it's this ultra anti-nostalgia, always looking forward thing that kind of teeters on, you know, there's something a little bit sad about I'm making all this art and no one's ever going to know it. But then there's also something incredibly freeing in that as well.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you get that, because that's that song I'm really proud of. At least lyrically, I'm really proud of it. Because I always thought, God, I can't be writing songs about songwriting. I can't be the guy who just writes about songwriting. But I thought I'd let myself have one. That's my one. Because I mean, obscurity, like, it's it can be disheartening, and if you write songs or make any art in with an audience in mind, or with or for the goal of people listening to it, I mean, chances are you're going to be disappointed. It's I don't mean that as discouragement, that's just how it is, but that's also awesome. It's great. You can do whatever you want. You can create for the sake of creativity, and that's something I think only clicked into my head pretty recently, that creativity for its own sake is special, and everyone should do it, you know.
Yeah, it is, you know, if you read the lyrics in the vacuum without, or parts of the lyrics in the vacuum without sort of the musical backing, it would almost seem mean in some ways, because it's like, well, no one's listening. You can dance like nobody's watching because nobody is. But
Yeah.
you know, your narrator and you are saying, no, there, this is awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that specific lyric, "Dance like no one was watching," no, I had that written in like a little notepad years ago. It's like a loose lyric, and I thought, "Oh, that's for a mean song. That's for a song insulting someone." And then I thought, "How do I develop it?" That was the moment where the song worked, is where I realized, "Wait, hang on, I'm looking at this from the completely wrong angle. I need to. This isn't a mean lyric at all. This is an uplifting lyric. This is motivation. This is like." The idea of no one caring is a celebration, you know. I was real pleased when I put that together.
And I know there's kind of like metaphor, not metaphor, because the character in this case is actually like putting up all of these manuscripts and burning them, you know, to the ground. But, you know, he's got the lyric, when you burn your masterpiece, you should be eternal, you should be released. And seconds later, you won't remember a thing. Is that kind of this the okay, you finished the thing, take exactly 1 second to acknowledge you finished the thing and then move to the next one?
Exactly. I mean, I'm kind of like that anyway. I mean, even Cacophony, it's been out for a month and I already feel like it was years ago and I'm completely moved on. But again, it's not about the result in this arena. It's about the process, is about doing it. It's about quantity, I guess. Quantity over even quality, maybe.
Did you in the past have a relationship with like perfectionism? Because I've heard recently like this great phrase, which is perfectionism is just sneaky anxiety.
That's great. That's so great. And I agree with it, you know. I feel very, very grateful that I'm not a perfectionist. I'm because I God, it would kill me, you know. I'd still be working on album one. And by the time it would be done, it would probably be worse than what I'm doing now. You know, I think the quickest way to make a perfect record is to make 100 not perfect records, you know? I maybe had dreams of like when I was like 16 thinking, oh, I'm going to make the most intricate, effortless chamber pop record that's going to blow everyone's mind and have no flaws. And then I started singing and I realized I couldn't, and I got over that pretty quick.
The next album was about bugs.
Yeah, I've started writing that. I was just writing it before we hopped on the call. I have a slightly insane way of doing it where I'm always thinking like two albums ahead concept wise. So I knew this would be about bugs back when I was doing album one. You know, I don't know why. I wanted to write. Well, it's about bugs and the apocalypse. Is the pitch? It's about a world where all the humans are dead and bugs rule the earth, which is about as you know. If you thought cacophony was whimsical and annoying, boy, you ain't heard nothing yet. And as long as you're